And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Innal ladhina amanu wal ladhina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillah. Innal ladhina amanu wal ladhina hajaru wajahadu في سبيل الله أولئك يرجون رحمة الله أولئك يرجون رحمة الله والله غفور رحيم. يسألونك عن الخمر والميسر قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men. And their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli forces continue to pound areas across the Gaza Strip, raising the death toll from the genocide to over 39,320. Israeli forces launch a new round of incursions into the occupied West Bank, abducting several youths in the Palestinian territory. Also in the headlines, Venezuela's Electoral Council declares the incumbent Maduro the winner of the presidential election with over 51% of the votes. Thanks for joining us. Israel keeps raining down bombs and shells on Gaza, killing at least 30 Palestinians in its fresh attacks. Most of the new killings took place in the flashpoint city of Khan Yunis. 17 civilians lost their lives in an airstrike on a residential building, while three others were killed after Israeli warplanes bombed tents housing the displaced in the Al-Mawasi area. A number of other Palestinians also fell victim to separate attacks on Khan Yunis. Gaza City was not safe from airstrikes either. Four civilians were killed in a fresh attack there. The death toll from the genocide in Gaza since October the 7th has topped 39,300, most of them women and children. The U.S. has been aiding and abetting Israel in its bombardment of Gaza, which makes Washington complicit in the genocide. Muti Abu Musab is a correspondent joining us from Darabala to tell us more. Muti, good morning. Over to you.
Yes, first of all, let me begin with the central area of Gaza Strip, where as 29,000 Palestinian civilians were forcibly expelled out of Al-Burayj refugee camp, in addition to vast parts of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp after the Israeli military issued evacuation orders for the Palestinian people to flee the entire areas of Al-Burayj refugee camp. And they demanded the Palestinian people to go to Al-Mawasi area, knowing that Al-Mawasi area is completely overcrowded with hundreds of thousands of the Palestinian civilians who are taking shelter in those areas after the Israeli occupation forces expelled them out of their residential areas in all areas of Gaza Strip. It's worth mentioning that every time the Israeli military demands the Palestinian people to evacuate from the camps of the central area of Gaza Strip, they demand them to go to Deir al-Balah. This time, the Israeli military demanded the Palestinian people from Al-Burayj and Al-Nusayrat refugee camp to go to Al-Mawasi area in the western part of Khan Yunis city. This actually raises more concerns among the people in Deir al-Balah city that Deir al-Balah could be subjected to another ground offensive over the upcoming weeks and days. So the current situation is extremely difficult and dire at all levels. Those Palestinian people who were expelled out of Al-Burayj refugee camp, actually, they fled the area without anything. They just left trying to take shelter in any place. A lot of them actually slept the last night and spent the last night in the streets as they are unable to afford the cost of, as you know, being displaced in Al-Mawasi area. Due to the absence of the transportations and the cars and the vehicles that they need to use in order to move to those areas. The current situation is extremely unbearable for those Palestinian people, the Palestinian families. In the meantime, the Israeli warplanes also resumed their airstrikes and attacks against Al-Burayj refugee camp. At least five residential buildings were pounded by the Israeli fighter jets over the last night in Al-Burayj refugee camp. In the meantime, the Israeli artillery continued to shell the eastern part of Deir al-Balah and Al-Burayj, in addition to the northern part of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. When it comes to Khan Yunis city, as you know, the Israeli occupation forces are still carrying out their brutal ground offensive against the eastern part of Khan Yunis city. We are talking about chronic and ceaseless artillery shelling targeting Bani Suhaila, Al-Karara, Abasan, and Gizan and Najjar areas. As you know, massive destruction left behind those ongoing and non-stop attacks carried out by the artillery, in addition to the airstrikes that targeted several parts of those areas. Needless to mention that the current situation in the western part of Khan Yunis city, basically Al-Mawasi area, is extremely excruciating for the Palestinian people who are still taking shelter there. Those people are still trapped between the ongoing and the ceaseless Israeli attacks. And the catastrophic humanitarian conditions that are still plaguing the Palestinian families there due to the severe shortage and lack of the basic humanitarian essentials, basically when it comes to the humanitarian items and the drinkable water that people are suffering all along because of the Israeli policies against them. When it comes to Gaza City, the Israeli attacks actually were insistent against the Israeli attacks were ongoing and insistent against those areas, basically a Sabra neighborhood, whereas the Israeli fighter jets destroyed multiple residential buildings there, in addition to a residential apartment. Scores of the Palestinian casualties were left behind those ongoing attacks. In the meantime, the Israeli artillery continued to shell the southern part of Sabra and Tal El Hawa neighborhoods. Scores of the Palestinian people were injured, and as you know, they transported to Al Ma'badani, the Baptist hospital in the southern part of Gaza City. It's worth mentioning that the three Palestinian dead bodies were.
Okay, it looks like we lost a correspondent there. We got an idea about what is going on there. Mutiaba Musaba there from Darren Bala, correspondent. Moving on, a Geneva-based rights group says Israel's evacuation orders and forced displacements of Palestinians all over Gaza amounts to war crimes and crimes against humanity. In a statement, the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor said that 2 million Gazans have been forcibly displaced from their homes, most of them multiple times. The group accused Israel of forcing Palestinians to live in inhumane conditions on the streets and in tents, while the regime continues its land, air, and sea assault. Meanwhile, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, said only 14% of Gaza is not under evacuation orders. The UNRWA chief added the evacuation is another form of torture and misery, as Palestinians keep searching for safety, which does not exist anymore. The latest round of Gaza ceasefire talks has been held in the Italian capital. Representatives from the U.S., Qatar, Egypt, and Israel took part in the negotiations, while no Palestinian representative was in attendance. Our correspondent Max Civilli has more from Rome.
On Sunday, a summit aimed at discussing a ceasefire agreement in Gaza and the release of Israeli captives held by Hamas kicked off in Rome. The meeting was attended by CIA Director William Burns, Prime Minister of Qatar Mohammed bin Abdel Rahman Al Thani, head of the Egyptian intelligence Abbas Kamal, and the head of Israel's Mossad spy agency David Barnea. No Palestinian representative was invited to join the summit. The Israeli representative to the talks, David Barnea, however, returned to Israel according to an announcement by the regime. He left the negotiations in Rome, presumably to monitor the situation following a rocket attack on a football pitch in the town of the Majdal Shams in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights, where at least 12 people were killed and 30 others wounded. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah categorically denied any responsibility for the strike. Palestinians residing in Italy expressed pessimism that any positive outcome can be achieved through the Rome summit.
I think that this meeting is part of a strategy that allows Netanyahu to buy even more time to continue with his massacres in Gaza and Lebanon. If the US and the Europeans really wanted to reach peace in Gaza, they would have stopped sending weapons to Israel long ago. Israel has never complied with international norms and has broken hundreds of UN resolutions.
International media have reported that ahead of the Rome summit, Israel submitted an updated proposal to Washington for a deal with Hamas, which includes new demands for negotiation, including establishing a monitoring mechanism for the movement of Palestinian weapons and resistance fighters, and maintaining Israeli control over the Philadelphia corridor between Gaza and Egypt. This condition could hamper the Gaza ceasefire negotiations. Palestinian factions Hamas and Fatah have recently signed a joint statement in Beijing aimed at ending divisions between the two rivals. In a meeting brokered by China, representatives from the groups, along with 12 other Palestinian factions, have pledged to work on forming an interim national reconciliation government for the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip.
The Rome summit must be seen against the backdrop of the deal inked between Hamas and Fatah, as well as the roles of different mediators in Gaza ceasefire talks. Tel Aviv's decision to hold the meeting in Rome can be seen as a way to reward Giorgio Meloni's government for its staunch support for Israel and the U.S.
The Rome summit will continue for at least 2 more days, even though no major breakthrough in Gaza ceasefire talks is expected. Meanwhile, fears are growing over the eruption of an all-out war in West Asia amid Israel's repeated threats to other countries. Max Civili, Rome.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has declared the next Saturday as a national and international day in support of Gaza and Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Hamas Political Bureau Chief Esmael Haniyeh called for a massive turnout in pro-Gaza demonstrations on August the 3rd. He said demonstrators on that day to demand an end to the Gaza genocide and Israel's abuse of heroic Palestinian prisoners. Elsewhere on his call, Haniyeh referred to Israel as the Nazi Zionist occupation, saying the number of Palestinian detainees killed in the regime's custody has seen an unprecedented increase. The Hamas chief also slammed international silence on Gaza and the inability to stop the aggression against the Palestinian nation and its prisoners at Israel's detention centers. He also denounced the U.S. for its unbridled support for Israel. Israeli forces have conducted a fresh raid in the occupied West Bank, abducting at least 7 Palestinians. Regime forces took the abductees away after storming south of Bethlehem. A young Palestinian man was also abducted during Israeli soldiers' raid on his home in Tul Karem. Earlier, several other Palestinians had also been arrested in overnight Israeli raids across the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have abducted more than 9,800 Palestinians across the occupied West Bank since October, when the regime started its genocidal war. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro has won re-election to another 6-year term in office.
With 80% of the polling stations counted and a 59% turnout, the results are as follows. First, Nicolas Maduro Moros obtained 5,150,992 votes with 51.2%. We congratulate the new president of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, candidate Nicolas Maduro Moros.
Maduro has hailed his win as a victory against what he called imperialism. He's been already in power for 12 years, and the win gives him a third term. But his main opponent, Edmundo Gonzalez, who was quick to claim victory after the election, has refused to recognize the results. Gonzalez is alleging irregularities and has called for a new vote. Lebron has congratulated Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro on his victory in the country's presidential elections. Iran's acting foreign minister welcomed the large turnout in the election, despite threats and unfair sanctions it has been facing. Ali Barrikhani reiterated Iran's support for Venezuela's national development plans, calling for stronger bilateral cooperation. The Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel also offered his congratulations to Maduro on his election win, describing it as a historic triumph. Earlier, Camila Escalante gave us a picture of the general mood in Venezuela after Nicolas Maduro's win in the presidential vote.
This country has seen time and time again, when the opposition loses, they refuse to accept the result. There have been two dozen or more elections in the last 20 years. And when they lose, they tend to not accept the elections. But we saw the way in which the opposition tried to arm an operation to try to discredit and delegitimize the electoral process long before the vote took place. And if you're on social media right now and go to X, you can see all the statements that have been made by personalities and politicians such as Javier Milei, but many others of the Latin American right wing, and probably in Spain and other places as well. So it seems as if that's what's going to happen. There will be another attempt to try to delegitimize the elections that took place today, even though there was such convincing turnout. I'm not sure if you noted it in the story before I came on, but it was a very high turnout, far more than I think anyone expected, a 59%. And so that's a very convincing win, and it was, you know, a 50% win for Chavismo. That's really what it felt like here anyways, speaking to people. People are not happy with the way in which the opposition have gone outside of the country to seek sanctions and aggression from the United States. And so people voted for a project that they think is bettering the country right now and restoring the economy.
Protesters have booed the Israeli anthem at the Olympics amid growing anger over the regime's participation in the Games. The jeers and pro-Palestinian chants came before a football match between Israel and Paraguay. Protesters also held up genocide Olympic signs and waved Palestinian flags. Israel's anthem and its players were also booed during the team's Olympic opener against Mali. There's been heavy security presence around the Israeli contingent in Paris. That is because of the persisting protests over the regime's participation in the Games, despite widespread calls to ban it over the genocide in Gaza. We were earlier joined by Jerome Hughes from Paris, who shared with us people's reaction to the participation of the Israeli athletes in the 2024 Olympics. Let's take a listen.
People are so frustrated by the situation. I've been here since Thursday, and just moving around the city, speaking to people in restaurants, etc. You know, you mentioned the fact that Israel is participating, or I don't even offer an opinion, but I raised the subject. And really, across the board, people cannot believe that the Israeli regime is allowed to send athletes here to the Olympic Games. So that booing that you heard there, with any time that Israel is present on the stage, in terms of if it's going down the River Seine at the opening, at the start, or their first opening football match on Thursday, there is this reaction from ordinary people who are booing, who are jeering at Israel and are saying free Palestine, because they cannot believe that Tel Aviv has been allowed to send athletes here. People are very frustrated and they're very angry. And if you ask them, if you speak to them about it, they'd say it's unbelievable, because, of course, Israel is involved in a genocide, ethnic cleansing. The European Union and the United States are sending bombs to Israel so that they can use them against Palestinians. And people are just so frustrated. And they keep raising as well the fact that Russia has been banned and Belarus has been banned from these games. And yet Israel is allowed to send people.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Thank you so much for being with us. That's bye-bye for now.
Is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness.
so to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Every empire falls. Its collapse becomes inevitable once its rulers lose all sense of how absurd and abhorrent they have become. Only a failing U.S. empire would be so blind as to cheer Netanyahu and his genocide. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for the second part. Middle East Eye wrote, in the U.S. Congress recently, some Democrats preferred to stay away, including party power broker Nancy Pelosi. Instead, she met families of Israeli hostages held in Gaza. Not, of course, Palestinian families whose loved ones in Gaza had been slaughtered by the child-killing regime of Israel. Vice President Kamala Harris explained her own absence as a scheduling conflict. She met the Zionist regime prime minister, as did President Joe Biden recently. Afterwards, she claimed to have pressed Netanyahu on the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza, but stressed too that Israel had a right to defend itself. A right that the Zionist regime specifically does not have, as the ICJ pointed out last week, because the Zionist regime is the one permanently violating the rights of the Palestinians through its prolonged occupation, apartheid rule, and ethnic cleansing. But the dissident of Pelosi and of Harris, if that is what it was purely performative. True, they have no personal love for Netanyahu, who has so closely allied himself and his government with the U.S. Republican right and former President Donald Trump. But Netanyahu simply serves as an alibi. Both Pelosi and Harris are stalwart supporters of the Zionist regime, a regime that, according to the ICJ's judgment recently, decades ago, instituted apartheid rule in the Palestinian territories using an illegal occupation as cover to ethnically cleanse the population there. Their political agenda is not about ending the annihilation of the people of Gaza. It is acting as a safely valve for popular dissatisfaction among traditional democratic voters shocked by the scenes from Gaza. It is to deceive them into imagining that behind closed doors there is some sort of policy fight over the Zionist regime's handling of the Palestinian issue. That voting Democrat will one very distant day, lead to an undefined peace, a fabled two-state solution where Palestinian children won't keep dying in the interest of preserving the security of the Zionist regime's illegal settler militias. U.S. policy towards the Zionist regime has not changed in any meaningful sense for decades, whether the president has been red or blue, whether Trump has been in the White House or Barack Obama. And if Harris becomes president, admittedly, a big if, U.S. arms and money will continue flowing to Israel, while Israel will get to decide if USA to Gaza is ever allowed in. Why? Because Israel is the linchpin in a U.S. imperial project for global full-spectrum dominance. Because for Washington to change course on Israel, it would also have to do other unthinkable things. It would have to begin dismantling its 800 military bases around the planet, just as the Zionist regime was told by the ICJ last week to dismantle its dozens of illegal settlements on Palestinian territory. The U.S. would need to agree a shared global security architecture with China and Russia, rather than seek to bully and batter these great powers into submission with bloody proxy wars, such as the one in Ukraine. Pelosi, remember, smeared students on U.S. campuses protesting the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza as being linked to other countries. She urged the FBI to investigate them for pressuring the Biden administration to support a ceasefire. Netanyahu, in his address to Congress, similarly demonized the demonstrators in his case by accusing them of being useful idiots of the Zionist regime's foes. Neither can afford to recognize that millions of ordinary people across the U.S. think it is wrong to bomb and starve children, and to use a war with an unachievable aim as the cover story. Hamas cannot be eliminated through the Zionist regime's current bout of horrifying violence for a very obvious reason. The resistance group is a product, a symptom of earlier bouts of horrifying Israeli regime violence. As even Western counterterrorism experts have had to concede, the Zionist regime's genocidal policies in Gaza are strengthening the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, not weakening it. Men and boys who lose their family to Israeli regime bombs are Hamas' most fervent new recruits. That's why Netanyahu insisted the Zionist regime's military offensive, the genocide in Gaza, could not end soon. He demanded weapons and money to keep his troops in the enclave indefinitely, in an operation he termed as demilitarization and de-radicalization. Decoded, that means a continuing horror show for the Palestinians there, as they are forced to continue living and dying with an Israeli aid blockade, starvation bombs, and unmarked kill zones. It means, too, an indefinite risk of the Zionist regime's war on Gaza spilling over into a regional war and potentially a global one, as tripwires towards escalation continue to grow in number. The U.S. Congress, however, is too blinded by championing its small fortress state in the West Asia region to think about such complexities. Its members roared USA to their satrap from Israel, just as Roman senators once roared glory to generals whose victories they assumed would continue forever. The rulers of the Roman Empire no more saw the coming fall than their modern counterparts in Washington can. But every empire falls, and its collapse becomes inevitable once its rulers lose all sense of how absurd and abhorrent they have become.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The Zionist lobby plays down the amount it spends on influencing policy in the United States. So in today's show, we'll be laying bare the reality. To set the scene, Latifa Abu Chakra has this report about the way in which the Zionist lobby's expenditure is reported.
AIPAC, or to give it its full name, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, is perhaps the best known Israel lobby group in the world. But how important is it really? Some say that its influence has been exaggerated and that, in the end, the most it can do is influence policies at the margins. Certainly, the Zionist movement is keen to downplay its influence. Here is a report in the tablet. How influential is AIPAC? Less than beer sellers, public accountants, and Toyota. Among the points made are that the way AIPAC is talked about, you'd think they'd be a lobbying juggernaut, surely one of the largest in the nation's capital. Wrong. Between 1998 and 2018, AIPAC didn't make a dent in the Center for Responsive Politics' list of the top spending lobbying groups. In 2018, total pro-Israel lobbying spending was around $5 million, of which AIPAC accounted for $3.5 million. In contrast, Native American casinos spent around $22 million that year. By tablets count, AIPAC was the 147th highest ranked entity in terms of lobbying spending in 2018. This is an attempt to pretend that the influence of the Zionist movement is much less than suggested by critics. Against that, we can set the following. Taking the figure disclosed to the lobbying regulator as if that was all APAC spends on lobbying is profoundly mistaken. Though it disclosed only $2.7 million lobby expenditure in 2022, its actual expenditure was $79.1 million. In addition, APAC controls another nonprofit, which it uses to pursue Zionist interests, which discloses nothing to the regulator, yet had a 2022 expenditure of a further $44.6 million. Looking more widely at the Israel lobby in general, in fact, declared lobbying expenditure by the lobby in 2018 was $7 million, not around $5 million, as stated by the tablet. The figure for 2022 was $5.4 million. But even that is woefully inadequate, as it does not include, for example, the $6.3 million spent in 2022 by Israeli firms, including arms firms, Elbit, Rafael, Israel Aerospace Industries, and phone hacking firm Celebrite. $16 million in the same year spent by registered foreign agents of Israel, including the government, the World Zionist Organization, the Jewish Agency, and the phone hacking firm NSO Group. But even that pales into insignificance when compared with the data compiled by the IsraelLobby.org website. Data compiled there on Zionist groups providing subsidy to the Zionist entity, including to illegal settlements and the occupation forces, and lobbying and education, shows a total budget of $3.6 billion as long ago as 2012, rising to an estimate $6.3 billion in 2020. It's time to get real about the spending power of the lobby.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert and eminent scholarly critic of Israel, David Miller. David's a senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeym University, and he's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Today's guest contributor is an American human rights lawyer, Dan Kovalik. Dan taught international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh until last year, and he's written extensively too. His books have focused on human rights and US foreign policy, and his latest book, The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care, was published in May this year and includes a foreword by George Galloway. Welcome to the show. David, what's behind the rationale then, you think, with the Zionists trying to minimise the influence of APAC?
Well, the Zionists try and pretend that they don't really exist. I mean, when you say that an organisation is a Zionist organisation, they quite often say, oh, no, it's just an ordinary Jewish communal organisation. And you point out that in their constitution they say they support Israel or that they're affiliated to the World Zionist Organization. They don't want to have any open conversation about what the Zionist movement is, about the existence of it, about the existence of the Israel lobby or the Zionist lobby. And so they try and pretend that it's not really a very significant thing. Yes, of course, they lobby for Israel, but it's just like any other lobby. There's nothing to see here. Don't even bother yourself about this. So it's an attempt to try and divert attention away from the actual facts about how the Zionist movement, the Israel lobby, operates.
Mm. Well, Dan, you've confronted APAC-supported politicians about their unwillingness to back a ceasefire, like the Democrat Senator John Fetterman. I mean, tell our viewers what actually happened.
Yeah, so I nicely went up to Senator Fetterman, who's a Democrat, who I actually supported at one time, and I said that he should consider supporting a ceasefire because of all the deaths that have been caused by Israel and Gaza, and half of them children. And before talking for very long, he had me thrown out of the venue that I had a ticket for, by the way, physically removed, and he never even bothered to try to answer my question or explain his position. And, since that time, that was pretty early on. I think that was in maybe even October of 2023 or early November. He's become even more kind of entrenched in his support for Israel, even willing to really do provocative things against his own electorate, his own voters, in support of Israel. So that's kind of incredible.
Well, David, I mean, you know, when you scratch the surface, it becomes apparent that AIPAC spends a lot more than the $3 million that it declared to the lobbying regulator, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, if you look at its actual budget and the budget of one of its front groups, it's the Educational Foundation, they spend their actual budgets are in the region of almost $100 million a year, which, of course, is quite a lot more than $3 million. But in addition, of course, people don't understand this, that they're also involved in campaign contributions, meaning giving money to candidates who they want to be elected or for candidates who they want to stop other people being elected. And that money, which they raise it through what's called a PAC or a super PAC, which is a political action committee. They've raised in the current year something like $13 million from one of them and about $30-odd million from their super PAC, which is called the United Democracy Project, crazy name. So that all that money, that's $80 million roughly, or slightly less than that, isn't accounted for in AIPAC spending. It's money that they raise. And that's the key to understanding this. The AIPAC is not the Israel lobby. It's one organization in a nexus of other organizations. And they, of course, coordinate with each other. They raise funds with each other. And it doesn't mean that they have to declare that money to the federal regulators, because, of course, it's not even their spending. But nevertheless, they are raising this money, significant sums of money, which people don't have any clear understanding is part of what they do.
Yes, indeed. It makes a mockery, doesn't it, of the regulator when they can get away with under-reporting like that. But let me ask you, Dan, I mean, what's your assessment of the importance of AIPAC?
Well, they're one of the most influential lobbies in the United States. I think they even bragged, frankly, that all the AIPAC-supported candidates won their primaries this year, which is a pretty incredible thing. They spend millions of dollars on to support pro-Zionist candidates every year. And that does a few things. One, it helps get pro-Zionist candidates elected, but it also keeps those candidates very beholden to them and to their viewpoint. They sponsor a lot of trips to Israel of freshman senators and congresspeople, again, wedding people to the Zionist project. They're very, very influential and have been for decades. You know, quite interestingly, John F. Kennedy actually tried to rein the AIPAC in by trying to get them to register as a foreign agent under the FARA Act, which existed back then and exists today. And of course, he ended up being killed. Some link those two issues. I you know, I'll leave that for others to decide. But in any case, they've been very influential for a long time.
Well, David, I mean, you know, some people might think that the $6.3 billion figure that Latifa referred to in her report there was an overestimate. I mean, what do you make of it? I mean, well, it sounds a lot, doesn't it?
Well, that's an estimate from 2020, so of course you would expect it to have risen.
So it's gone even higher then?
Well, you would expect it to rise to something like $7 billion, perhaps, and if you use the same methodology which they used back then.
Yeah.
But of course, the problem with those estimates is that there are a minimal estimate. The actual funds spent in the budget of these organizations is way larger. Now, let me tell you two ways in which that's the case. For example, it doesn't include in it, there's an organization called the American Zionist Movement, which is the U.S. Affiliate of the World Zionist Organization. It has 46 members. Only 13 of those members are included in this data. So there's another 30-odd members who are not included, so their budgets wouldn't be included. They have two branches of the Chabad organization, that kind of ultra-extremist Zionist organization. If you look up the IRS database, there are 1,300 branches throughout the whole of the U.S., so that's an underestimate. Not a single one of the foundations which funds all of this, the Zionist Family Foundations, none of them are included either. So if you actually wanted a budget for the full budget of the Zionist movement, it would go way higher than $6 billion a year.
Wow, that's incredible. Well, Dan, I mean, do AIPAC work then actively work with other Zionist groups, do you know?
I guess I don't know for sure, but I mean, they must. Again, they're a very influential organization, very well organized. I think they have a lot of influence, not just, you know, politically, but also in the greater U.S. society, in think tanks and whatnot.
Well, our next report addresses the insidious influence of AIPAC on the political system in the United States.
AIPAC has a deserved reputation as the most powerful Israel lobby group in the U.S., though a key Zionist talking point is the claim that it is not so powerful. AIPAC was created by Isaiah Kennan, a contractor for the Zionist regime in 1963. It was initially called the American Zionist Council. 2 months after the American Zionist Council was ordered to register as a foreign agent, Kennan incorporated AIPAC. It did not register as a foreign agent, though it obviously is. Since then, AIPAC has been periodically investigated by the FBI and the U.S. Department of Justice, but never forced to register as a foreign agent. One element of AIPAC activities not well understood is its role in spending millions every year ferrying dozens upon dozens of members to Israel for 8-day junkets. The trips are organized through a cutout called the American Israel Education Fund, a charitable organization founded by AIPAC from which it borrows its offices, board members, and even part of its logo. Like other tax-exempt nonprofits, IF must file a Form 990 every year with the Internal Revenue Service, but donors are redacted from the public version. Recently, an unredacted tax filing for 2019 was obtained by The Intercept. It reveals the financiers are a clutch of large foundations and nonprofits, some of which are family-run, which also give to the other genocidal Zionist groups. They include foundations associated with the following families: Koret, Schwartz, Schuchterman, and Singer. The role of AIPAC in campaign contributions is also poorly understood. In November 2023, it was reported that AIPAC was airing attack ads and beginning to back primary opponents to challenge Congress members who are not voting for or supporting Israel's war on Gaza. In spring this year, it was revealed that AIPAC had a $100 million war chest for its upcoming election cycle. AIPAC's super PAC is humorously named the United Democracy Project. It spends targeted funds on any lawmakers who challenges any pro-Israel policy, including the mildly critical so-called squad of Democrat representatives and also libertarian Republicans such as Thomas Massie, who has voted against military aid to Israel. Massie it was who revealed in an interview with Tucker Carlson that AIPAC appoints handlers for each congressperson. Here is his description.
Everybody but me has an AIPAC person.
What's like, that mean, an AIPAC person?
It's like your babysitter, your AIPAC babysitter, who is always talking to you for AIPAC. They're probably a constituent in your district, but they are firmly embedded in AIPAC.
In November 2022, AIPAC claimed that more than 95% of AIPAC-backed candidates won their election last night. In July 2024, AIPAC claimed, so far this cycle, all 90 AIPAC-endorsed Democrats have won their primary election. AIPAC must be stopped.
Dan, I mean, what did you make of the revelations in our report there?
Yes, well, again, it is a strange anomaly that AIPAC does not have to register as a foreign agent because, in fact, they are a foreign agent. They represent the interest of Israel in the United States. They are have more influence than probably any other group that is registered with FAR, right? I mean, they make various journalists who work for outlets like RT, even I think Press TV, although I don't know if many operate within the United States anymore, but at the time they were, they would make those, you know, RT, Press TV, other foreign journalist organizations and journalist register as foreign agents, even though, you know, the reach of those news organizations, frankly, is not huge in the United States.
David, tell us a bit more, will you, about this educational charity that acts as a front for AIPAC on these funding trips to the settler colony.
So this is an organization set up by AIPAC. It's not secret that they've set up, but it's an organization which has a budget round about the same as APAC, just a bit less, something like 40 or 50 million a year, none of which, of course, is declared as lobbying expenditure to the lobbying regulator because it's not required to be. Mm. It's only direct meetings with politicians with the intent of influencing their decision making. Now, of course, you might think that taking them on an 8-day junket to the occupied Palestinian colony might be an opportunity for them to lobby them and to convince them and to school them on the importance of supporting Israel, but that doesn't count according to the way in which the regulators work. So it doesn't. So none of that appears. So when people talk about, well, APAC only spends $3 million a year on lobbying, and it's not even as much as the Association of Realtors, for example. And then you have to say, well, you look at this organization. Mm. That's another. It doubles up the APAC budget, takes it up to almost $100 million, not even including campaign contributions. And so it's there to take these Congress people to the settler colony. And what they do when they're there, of course, is they, in the time-honored tradition, they propagandize them. Now, 80% of Congress people have been taken on such trips, 80%. Mm. And that's more than in the case in the UK where it was a lower figure. So that of course shows the way in which they try and get every single person they can to go to these trips in order that they can convince them that they should vote for more and more guns and bombs to kill Palestinian children. And that's the deal. That's what it's for.
Mm. Interesting. Well, Dan, what about the disclosure that AIPAC appoints handlers for every Republican lawmaker?
Yeah, well, again, what it shows is that, you know, once a candidate becomes a candidate who received AIPAC money and is elected, they're bought and sold, right? They've now been bought and paid for by AIPAC, and AIPAC expects something in return. And as you say, they even have handlers to make sure that those Congress people continue to vote the way that AIPAC wants. So again, it's really affected U.S. politics, perverted U.S. politics in a very big way.
David, you know, some on the left actually echo these Zionist talking points, don't they, about minimizing the reality of AIPAC's power, don't they? I mean, not really doing a great service, are they, to the cause?
Well, I think that there's a problem on the left, which is that there's an assumption that it must be the case that U.S. imperialism is in charge. Therefore, cannot be the case that the Israel lobby has any real influence. It might have some marginal influence at the edges, but it cannot be the case, mm-hmm. as a matter of theory, that it can have that kind of power. So, as a result of that, what happens is that people on the left who write about these things don't really write about what the Zionists get up to. So they might quote the 3 million figure for the lobbying, or they might say, well, the APAC did this or they did that, but they won't talk about the rest of the lobby, they won't talk about the Zionist movement, they won't talk about the billions and billions of dollars which are clearly spent every year. But even if you grant them the argument that actually the US empire is in charge and the Zionists only have some kind of minimal influence, well, you need to be able to demonstrate that. And no one on the left is going so far as to demonstrate that and say, what is it that AIPAC does? How does it relate to the ADL? How does it relate to the Hillel network of student Zionist organizations? There's a huge network out there. And, of course, you see someone like Blinken, whose father, of course, was one of the early Zionists, Zionists infest the government of Joe Biden, and they infest also Republican governments. So you have a difficulty in explaining how that was the case without actually doing any proper research about it. And there's precious little research on the left.
Yeah. Well, Dan, how do you think people should push back against the lobby, in your opinion?
Well, you know, there's direct ways and indirect ways. I mean, the indirect way, which I think is the best, is to continue to tell the truth about what's happening in Israel, to tell the truth about what's happening in Gaza, to undermine the propaganda that AIPAC puts forward, that its candidates and its politicians put forward. And that's been very effective since October 7th. I mean, the narrative that AIPAC and the Zionists in general have managed to put forward since 1948 has greatly fallen apart due to the efforts of individuals and organizations who have simply spoken the truth about the atrocities in Gaza. I think that's the best way, frankly, to challenge AIPAC. But the other way to directly challenge it is to expose AIPAC, expose its influence over politicians, expose the monies that it dumps into elections. And again, to just tell the truth about it. I think the truth is always the most effective and impactful way to challenge political influencers.
So, David, then, I mean, overall, how powerful do you think AIPAC really is then?
I think that's the wrong question. I mean, what you've got to understand is that we don't just have the Israel lobby, of which AIPAC is a preeminent example, not the only example by any means. There are hundreds of other Israel lobby groups in the US. But there's the Zionist movement. So the Zionist movement is there, yes, to influence government policy, foreign policy and domestic policies where it affects the Zionist entity. But it's also there to radicalize and indoctrinate a cadre of leaders, starting with Jewish kids as young as 3 and 4, through Jewish schools, which are Zionist, through Zionist synagogues, through Zionist youth groups, and then encourage American citizens, British citizens, to join the IDF, for example. And so they're trying to bring through a whole cadre of people who can, yes, help to go and kill Palestinians, but also can infiltrate the political system of the US, the UK, and everywhere else that they're active. So it's not just a question of the Israel lobby, of AIPAC, but you have to see the way in which AIPAC operates in relation to other Zionist organizations and how they work as a network to try and pursue their interests.
Yes, well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So I'd like to thank our guest, Dan Kovalik, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Remember, you can follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Telegram, where we post regular clips and updates. And our entire back catalogue of programmes is now available on Rumble too. And don't forget to share today's programme on your social media platforms to help us continue expanding our audience and to provide an antidote to the corporate media's misreporting on Palestine. So until next time, when I hope you'll join us again on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أعظم الله أجورنا وأجوركم بمصابنا بالحسين عليه السلام. Welcome brothers and sisters, this is Viewpoint from IRIB English Radio. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accept all your mornings and deeds during the month of Muharram, the month of Azza. Here we are with another episode, and in this studio we have dear brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum dear brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And dear brother Sheikh Ahmad. Assalamu alaikum dear brother.
Assalamu alaikum.
Today we want to talk about the different aspect of Imam Hussein's uprising and his movement. Here, I would like to start the talk. Brother, we have read in the history of the world, especially in World War II, when Japanese pilot did so many suicide attacks against Allied warship. Later, we had Palestinian suicide bombers during the Second Intifada, which shocked the Western Cultural Front, and then 9/11 happened. So these were the incidents when the contemporary world got to know the concept of martyrdom and shahada. With this introduction, I want you to tell us about the meaning of shahada, martyrdom in Islam and Shia. What is this shahada, this martyrdom? And why is it this concept of shahada is so tangled and associated with the Shi'i world? Brother Ali, can you distinguish between promoting violence and hatred in a society and being a revolutionary kind of fan? Because some people say if you act against certain beliefs in a society, or let's say Islamic Ummah, in order to change some sort of values, you are actually weakening the pillar of that society. And it is not okay to do that. So what are the aims of promoting this being revolutionary in your idea?
Well, I think before answering this question, we need to know about what is violence. So violence means something that, I mean, a very harsh and a very severe action in front of any social or intellectual, or social or personal action or reaction. I mean, there's reactions that are usually very harsh, mm-hmm. are not coming from a sacred base. I mean, are not stemmed from something which is really profound and valuable. For example, in the realm of politics, if I do not agree with your viewpoints in the politics or in your political viewpoints, mm-hmm. so I come very harshly towards you and severely, I mean, stand in front of your beliefs just because I believe something else. I mean, this is something that, for example, violence means in the world of politics. But how can we compare it to the sacred concept of Shahada or martyrdom? Because martyrdom is usually a term that is being used for a person who sacrifices his life on the way of God, sometimes even just to defend his own land and geographical borders, mm-hmm. though it is very precious. But for the martyrdom, it is even something beyond that. I mean, you are defending the borders of culture, borders of your religion, borders of loyalty, borders of all the good actions and all the moralities. Mm-hmm. So this is more valuable than actually defending the physical and geographical borders. So a person who sacrifices his own life, his own soul for a whole society, the whole community, so it differs with a person who just is going to defend his political, stances, whether they are right or wrong. I mean, to prove that they are wrong or right, I mean, it takes even a long time. But we want to say a person who puts his life on his hands and delivers it to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, why? For the sake of God, to defend others, to actually serve other humankind. So what action better than helping and serving the humankind is on the earth? Based on some narrations, if we dive into religious sources, we see as if the Holy Prophet and the Imams, succeeding Imams after him, found nothing more precious than serving the humankind. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is very precious. So for the sake of these people, to defend them, to defend their lives, since their lives are precious, and they are, whether they are believers or unbelievers. So you are, I mean, giving whatever you have,
yeah,
for what they need to have. So this concept is very precious, if you want to compare it to these two. So in the concept of martyrdom that we are talking about, this cannot be compared to violence.